Hello and welcome to this very special four-episode mini-series for World Gynecologic Oncology Day. Starting on the 20th of September, we will be releasing an episode a week for 4 weeks. The theme for this year is Dare to Ask, so we'll be asking all the questions sent in by you and getting the answers from four incredible specialists. We have Professor Donal Brennan, who will be covering the surgical side of cancer. We have Dr. Karen Cadu, who will be focusing on genetics with a special interest in BRCA and Lynch syndrome. We have Helen Greeley, who is a psych-oncologist with the NCCP, and she will be discussing the psychological implications of carrying the BRCA gene and also managing some of the psychological symptoms that can come with early menopause. And we have Louise Comerford, CNS in Holles Street in St. Vincent's, who will be answering all of our nursing questions. We really hope you enjoy these four episodes.
This season is kindly sponsored by CarePlus Pharmacy, with all the proceeds being donated to the Emer Casey Foundation. The Emer Casey Foundation was founded in 2006 after the death at a young age of Emer Casey to ovarian cancer. We are so honoured to be a part of this movement to raise awareness of gynaecologic cancers, and we hope we can help you find the answers to some of your questions.
Good evening, Karen, and welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking your evening to speak to us tonight. We have a couple of questions in from patients in the run-up to World Gynecologic Oncology Day, which is very exciting, and the theme this year is Dare to Ask. So we have a number of questions in, and they're mostly around BRCA mutation, Lynch syndrome, and PARP inhibitors. So if you don't mind, Anne-Marie will take it away and we'll jump straight in.
Great.
Thanks, Karen, again, for joining us. So like Michelle said, we had a range of questions that came in about different topics. So we might start with the questions that were directed mainly towards risk and prevention with hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. So our first question is the risk of ovarian cancer the same if you have the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 gene mutation?
So thanks very much for having me, and it's great to have this opportunity to answer some people's questions. So to start with, the risk of having ovarian cancer is not exactly the same. So for women who have a BRCA1 mutation, their risk of ovarian cancer over their lifetime is about 40%. And for women with BRCA2, it's approximately 20%. But to think about those numbers as well, you have to think about them in the context of the population risk. So the population risk of ovarian cancer is about 1.5%. So the 20 to 40% risk that you have with a BRCA mutation is a good bit higher than that population risk. And the other thing that I kind of think it's important for people to think about, especially for younger women, is that what we talk about often in terms of those risks are a lifetime risk, but to think about how the risk changes over time. So for women who are in their early 20s, that risk hasn't started stacking up yet so much, but as they get older, towards their mid to late 30s and into their early 40s, those risks start getting higher. And that's part of why we think about intervention as women get a bit older. And the other thing I just want to say for one second about ovarian cancer risk is just in contrast to breast cancer risk, because ovarian cancer, which is what we're mainly talking about with World Gynec today, it may seem like the risk is lower in comparison to breast cancer, where there's a lifetime risk of about 70%, but the population risk of breast cancer is 12.5% in comparison to that 1.5% for ovarian cancer. So that's why I think it's important for people to think about their risks in comparison to the risk of a general woman in the population.
Mm-hmm. That's great, Karen. Thanks a million. And if you carry the BRCA gene and have had the risk reduction surgery, including the removal of your ovaries and the fallopian tubes, but you still have your uterus, can you develop ovarian cancer?
Yes. Yeah, so unfortunately, you can. With all things in life, nothing is perfect. So having a risk reducing oophorectomy greatly reduces your risk of having ovarian cancer, but does not make it nothing. So there's always a risk of primary peritoneal cancer, which is extraordinarily low. It depends a little bit on when you have your risk-reducing surgery. For women who find out older that they have a BRCA mutation, their risk of primary peritoneal cancer might be a bit higher if they have their ovaries out at the age of 60, for example, in comparison to a woman who has it out at the age of 40. If you have your uterus, though, that doesn't make any difference. So having a uterus still doesn't increase your risk of ovarian cancer. But of course, if you have a hysterectomy, then you've no risk of uterine cancer or little risk of uterine cancer, but it doesn't affect your risk of ovarian cancer or primary peritoneal cancer.
And then one really strong question that came in from a lot of people was that a lot of women have a lot of fear about passing the mutation onto their children. So we know that there is something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. So what is this available in Ireland to people with the BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene mutation?
So pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is where a woman goes through full IVF and can select embryos to select those that do not have the mutation that they know about in themselves or their family. And this is available in the private sector in Ireland. It's not currently available in the public sector. That may change. It is available privately, for example, in the United States. And it is available in the public sector in the United Kingdom with very strict criteria. I think there's plans to introduce the availability of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for high risk syndromes here, but I imagine that will also come with pretty strict criteria. So I don't exactly know what that's going to look like yet, but it is a watch this space for publicly available. But as I said, it is available through private IVF centres currently.
That's brilliant. We're hopeful to think that hopefully in the future it might be available more widely.
Yeah.
And then moving on from that, the risk reduction is a big focus for care for women with the BRCA mutations. So is there any plans for BRCA specialised medical led teams or clinics with gynae breast cancer patients to standardise best approach to managing this community in particular?
Yes, so the NCCP that's the National Cancer Control Program for people who are not familiar with it. So they organise a lot of the cancer care or prevention in Ireland, and they've organised a committee or task force who are looking at this question, addressing the needs of people who have a BRCA mutation and looking at it from a multidisciplinary perspective and how to exactly that standardise and put services in place that should be applicable nationally. So unfortunately, as we all know, things can be a little slow getting off the ground sometimes around here. But I think this committee or the instigation of this committee, which is new and hasn't met yet, but the fact that it exists at all, I think is great news. And I think will be a great avenue for progress very soon, hopefully. Mm-hmm. Not as soon as we'd like.
Yeah, exactly. Like everything, it takes time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the main thing. We might move on to another hereditary syndrome that can be associated to developing cancers, gynae cancers and colorectal cancers, which is called Lynch syndrome. So if you don't mind, would you mind explaining what Lynch syndrome is and when would you test for it?
Yes. So Lynch syndrome is another similar to people who have hereditary breast and ovarian cancer. It's a high penetrance germline predisposition genetic syndrome. And it, as you said, increases the risk of colon and endometrial cancer in particular, but also can increase the risk of ovarian cancer for women. And when we would test for it is usually in the context of a family history, or what is now happening or will happen soon is what we call universal screening. So for people who have a colon cancer diagnosis, their tumors are screened to see if they have missing proteins in that tumor. And if those proteins are missing, it doesn't mean that they've Lynch syndrome, but it means that additional testing needs to be done. This has been done pretty widely in Ireland for the last number of years, is my understanding, but it has not been done so widely in endometrial cancer. And really, we need, again, a standardized approach. And the NCCP, again, are working on this. The idea is that there should be universal screening of all colon endometrial cancer patients. If these proteins are absent on their tumor, they then have testing for Lynch syndrome. And if they have Lynch syndrome, then their family will be tested. So that's probably the biggest place that we're going to kind of pick up for this, or this is how we probably going to, this is the sort of place where we're going to find people who have Lynch syndrome. Apart from that kind of pathway, the other thing would be when there are families where there are a number of colon cancers, usually at a young age, and or endometrial cancers. So traditionally, people thought of this as a colon cancer syndrome and didn't perhaps recognize the role of gynecologic cancers. But I hope that is changing. And I think that greater recognition and awareness, people do appreciate that endometrial cancer is a key component of this syndrome.
And then for the women with Lynch syndrome that's been picked up, what is their risk factor for developing the gynaecology cancers? And is it equal to exceeding their risk of colon cancer?
So yes, I suppose is a straightforward answer. It depends a little on which mutation. So I should have said that there's a mutation, one of the mismatch repair genes. There are four mismatch repair genes, MLH1, MSH2, MSH6 and PMS2. The risk of endometrial cancer for women who have an MLH1, MSH2 or MSH6 mutation is fairly equal and similar to their colon cancer risk in general. The risk is a little lower with PMS2. For MSH6, however, the risk of colon cancer is a little lower. So for women who have an MSH6 mutation, their cancer risk is kind of similar to the other genes, but for men, it may be a little lower because it's driven by that lower colon cancer risk. And as I said, PMS2 is just a little bit more of a moderate or modest risk gene. In terms of the risk of ovarian cancer, it's lower across the board than endometrial cancer and a good bit lower than colon cancer. And it's somewhere around 10% for those three higher risk genes and probably a bit lower, but the data is not entirely clear for PMS2, probably more like 4% or so.
Mm-hmm. And then for women with the Lynch syndrome, we know that they're at an increased risk for, I suppose, like just anxiety and fear around the whole, sure. The whole scenario. So yeah. Is there personalized counseling regarding family planning and just in general for these particular cohort of patients?
Yes. So I think it's sort of, it's similar to the BRCA space. So, you know, unfortunately there isn't good screening for gynecologic cancers, unlike colon cancer. So that affects this landscape. So in terms of endometrial cancer, endometrial biopsies are not good screening, although they can be a good diagnostic test for endometrial cancer. And unfortunately, there's no real good screening for ovarian cancer. So for women, I think it's just being aware, whilst ovarian cancer can be very subtle in its presentation, bloating, altered appetite, bowel habits, abdominal distension, those kind of things. Endometrial cancer would often present with bleeding. So any kind of abnormal bleeding is one of the sort of flags that people should be looking for. And then in terms of risk reduction, it's similar to we talk about for ovarian cancer risk is risk reducing surgery and then a risk reducing hysterectomy in terms of endometrial cancer risk. And so in that context, then yes, women need to think about their family planning and what age they're going to have their kids. And then they also need to think about their other risks and what they can modify or reduce. Is true for all people in life, but particularly when you have a known risk factor. So one of the biggest drivers of endometrial cancer in the general population is obesity. So one of the things that to be aware of is to have a healthy diet and exercise and to maintain a normal body weight. There's no real data to say that that improves expectations in Lynch syndrome, but there's no reason why it wouldn't. So I would encourage women to maintain a healthy body weight if at all possible as well. So I think it's a lot of awareness and education. I do think that for gynecologic cancers, the awareness and education has lagged behind colon cancers in this syndrome. And so for women, it's been harder to get good education and information, but hopefully that's changing and going to change even more, where people are much more aware of the impact of the syndrome on their you know, potential in terms of family planning and lifestyle and those things. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then in terms of managing people with Lynch syndrome, so is surveillance for gynecologic cancers in women with Lynch syndrome an effective way to manage it?
Not really. The only effective management is risk reducing surgery. So, you know, in terms of ovarian cancer risk, doing vaginal ultrasounds and CA125 tests is not being shown to be beneficial. And in fact, the FDA recommended against doing that because it can falsely reassure people, although in discussion with their clinicians, some people do that. In terms of monitoring premenopausal women with ultrasounds from endometrial perspective, that's very challenging because their endometrial thickness varies in with their cycle. So endometrial biopsies can be useful from a diagnostic point of view, but screening is really challenging. So although it may be done in consultation with clinicians on an individualized basis, in general, the sort of key is risk reduction in terms of surgery for gynecologic cancers, and that really hasn't changed. Hopefully in the future, we will have a better answer. So there's work being done. For example, if you wash fluid up into the uterus and into the fallopian tubes and pull back that fluid and examine that, can you find signatures that may highlight future cancer risk? Or can you interpret these kind of specialized type of pap smears, cell brushings? So it really, a lot of work being done there. So hopefully in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll have more progress. But for now, there's not a good screening option that you could say really is a gold standard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then in terms of helping people to navigate a diagnosis of Lynch syndrome, like we said, it comes with an awful lot of fear attached to it. So oftentimes women can feel that there is a lack of clear information or pathways in regards to screening in comparison to, say, colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. So often we having to push for, they have to push for this themselves, which can not all the time be successful depending on how knowledgeable their GP or the waiting times may be. So how can we as healthcare professionals empower high risk patients to access the relevant screening systems?
Well, I suppose we could talk about both pieces, the gynecologic piece and then the colon cancer piece. So they do need screening for colon cancer. I think the key is education, of course, not just amongst the public, but healthcare providers, patients, everybody. As people become more and more familiar with these syndromes, I think it is key to kind of access, really. You know, we have lots of resource issues in this country, but when people understand what's needed, I think that's very helpful. If possible, especially if there's a mutation known within the family, I would say the key is to seeking testing as soon as possible. We know the waiting lists, unfortunately, for cancer genetics are longer, about 2 years for routine tests at the moment, which we're really working on. But for now, that's what it is. So I think the key would be, once a mutation is known in your family, to seek a referral from your GP to get that information as quickly as possible. So for younger women, for example, we wouldn't be recommending they've risk-reducing surgery yet, but that's not to say that they shouldn't go ahead to get the testing to have their colonoscopies done, number one, but also to perhaps get on that waiting list for a gynae appointment. You know, unfortunately, it's the reality that the wait lists are long, and so really advocating and pushing and being proactive is key. And as I said, one of the key things about this syndrome is the recognition of those gynecologic cancers across the board. And actually, there was a rebranding. So this used to be called hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer, and now it's called Lynch syndrome, partly in recognition of the, you know, great work that Henry Lynch did in the syndrome, but also to acknowledge that this isn't a colorectal cancer syndrome. It's a colorectal and endometrial cancer syndrome with then these other cancer risks, including ovarian cancer. So I think, as with all things, education and awareness, and then proactivity on the patient's part as best they can, which I know can be difficult.
Mm-hmm. And then just to touch off a little bit about the risk reduction surgeries. So I think you mentioned that there's a prophylactic hysterectomy and oophorectomies offered to people with Lynch syndrome to reduce cancer risk. But we're just wondering if there's any recent research that kind of is more up to date than that particular offer.
Not really. There are things that are in progress or potential, but nothing that I would say is sort of ready for everyday clinical use. So one of the things that's being explored is whether or not for women who have a BRCA mutation more predominantly, so where you can do what's called a salpingectomy. So that's removing the fallopian tube and then leaving the ovary in place until after menopause, and then removing the ovary. So a delayed oophorectomy, which is removal of the ovaries. So the question, women who have a BRCA mutation get what's called a high-grade serous ovarian cancer. That's the type of ovarian cancer that they get. And we know that those almost certainly arise in the fallopian tube. So if you do a salpingectomy, could you delay the oophorectomy and menopause part of it? And, you know, would that be beneficial? And that might be true, but we don't actually know if that's safe yet. There's ongoing clinical trials exploring that. In the context of Lynch syndrome, women tend to get clear cell and endometrioid ovarian cancers, and these are less common types and they're different. And whether or not they arise in the fallopian tube, or whether we can say that with such certainty, is not clear. And whether or not doing a salpingectomy would have the same impact, we don't even know for sure if it's the right thing to do in the context of a high-grade serous risk. There are, again, clinical trials exploring this question, some of which is a currently open clinical trial in the United States that's enrolling women with BRCA mutation only. And then there's other clinical trials that are enrolling women who have a number of different hereditary predispositions to ovarian cancer. So a lot to be done in terms of getting better data and knowing whether or not it's safe before we sort of make that something that's a kind of a everyday recommendation. And then the other things that are being looked at are things that I like I mentioned about, you know, doing washings or these kind of brushings, whether or not they actually may have more value potentially in Lynch syndrome than in the likes of BRCA or hereditary breast ovarian cancer syndrome, they may do. So a lot of good work being done. The other thing that people look at is cell-free DNA, whether or not you can pick up little small fragments of what may be becoming a tumor from your bloodstream in advance of that happening. Again, that's a lot of research and great scientific progress, but nothing that's ready for kind of useful everyday clinical practice. So we're a little stuck right now with risk reducing surgery, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Stuck, I suppose, right now. But like you say, like, it sounds really hopeful that there's lots happening in the background. Yeah. That would be really reassuring for people in itself, you know. So Michelle, I might hand over to you just to go to move on to our next section, which is more around kind of supportive therapies for gynecologic cancer.
Absolutely. Karen, thanks so much for that comprehensive overview. I think that'll definitely answer a lot of the questions that were sent in. I'm going to ask a couple of questions on HRT and PARP inhibitors, and I might start with HRT, if that's okay. Is HRT recommended after getting ovaries and tubes removed with BRCA2 gene mutation?
Yeah, so HRT is a really complex area, and it definitely requires individualized decision making. And there's a lot of factors involved in that decision making. And I know this is a very difficult space for people. So it depends partially on the age of the patient, whether they have a prior history of breast cancer, for example, or DCIS, which is sort of a pre-invasive lesion, what their family history is, what their individualized approach to risk is. So the question with hormone replacement therapy is whether or not it may increase your risk of breast cancer is the sort of main thing that we think about. So if someone's had a risk reducing mastectomy, then that gets factored into decision making potentially. So there's a lot of things to think about. And, you know, it does require kind of careful discussion and a plan. And the risks with hormone replacement therapy increase or sort of stack up a little bit over the duration of use. And so the kind of generalized approach is to have, it's not that you can't have HRT if you have a BRCA mutation, but it's a careful discussion about the potential benefit and the potential risks. Most people would recommend that you try to manage menopause symptoms with non-hormonal approaches first and see how things go. So it depends a little bit on what the symptom is and what the issue is. And for some women, that is a very reasonable approach. For some women, that's not at all a successful strategy. As I said, depends on the situation and particularly the patient age. So for women who are younger, if they start, or if with discussion and with consideration of any potential risks, they start hormone replacement therapy, the kind of usual approach is often to make a plan with the patient, think about how long they're going to be on it and when they're going to stop it. Because stopping hormone replacement therapy can be difficult for some women. And so in general, the concept is that when you have a premature menopause through surgery and you're starting hormone replacement therapy to manage symptoms, to have some plan to taper it and usually to stop it by the age of natural menopause, which is about 51. So a lot to unpack there, and also what type of hormone replacement therapy. So for women who haven't had a mastectomy, estrogen only hormone replacement therapy may be a better option than estrogen combined with progesterone. But for women who have a uterus, progesterone may increase their risk of endometrial cancer. So it depends a lot, as you can see, on all those different factors. And for an individual woman, what is the kind of most important pieces in decision? Are their symptoms so problematic that a small increased risk of breast cancer, which may be low in the context of their personal family history, over a young age span, if they stop at an appropriate time, versus for another woman, that mightn't be an acceptable answer at all, depending on the personal situation. So it's very difficult. I think it's hard for women to get good information sometimes about this. I was very interested to read at the weekend the paper that there's a menopause clinic or service being set up. And I really hope that that's something that'll help with good information and help with some of these complex decision making, or help facilitate some of these complex decision making for women. So I'm not sure exactly how that clinic is going to work, but it'll be very interesting to see. And hopefully the women who are at high risk will have a avenue there that will be very helpful to them. The other thing I'd like to do is plug Clinical Trial. Donal Brennan, who I know you're interviewing in another one of these series, is running a clinical trial through UCD for women who have menopausal symptoms. And that might be a good option for people. And we're also hoping to open another clinical trial in, it's probably might be the new year by the time we get to it, both in St. James's and in the Mater Vincent's group, for women who have menopausal symptoms. So, you know, hopefully there's more options coming down the track there too, both in terms of information and helping with decision making, but also non-hormonal strategies that might be helpful, these sort of new drug options. So let's watch this space there too.
Brilliant. And yeah, we're actually going to do a whole episode based on that trial, because it's by far our, so sometimes we put out just a kind of call out on Instagram for people to send us in messages what they want to cover. And by far, HRT and hormones and menopause symptoms is the most requested every time. So it's great to have this to really dig. So thanks a million. I think that will clear up a lot of questions for people. And if somebody has had their ovaries removed because they carry the BRCA gene and they cannot take HRT as they have had hormone positive breast cancer, are they at risk of osteoporosis, and what would you recommend?
So it depends on what age they have their ovaries removed, but if we're presuming that they were premenopausal, so if you have a menopause before the age of 45, that does increase your risk of osteoporosis. So there's a few things you can do. Don't smoke. Smoking affects your bone mineral density. Good healthy diet, calcium and vitamin D, weight bearing exercise, they're the kind of general things. And then you can have your bone density checked and monitored. So there's what's called a DEXA scan. And so if you have loss of bone density over time, you know, the same way that postmenopausal women can have their bone density checked, and then but just starting at a different time point, depending on when you have your ovaries removed. And then there are bone modifying agents, or mainly bisphosphonates, where they increase the bone density or increase bone strength. And, you know, these things are usually pretty, for most women, it's pretty straightforward to manage that. But part of that is an awareness, both on the patient and their provider's part, to be monitoring for that, of course.
Brilliant, thank you a million. And is there any evidence to suggest that the contraceptive pill can protect women from getting ovarian cancer? And if so, does it matter if it's the single or combined hormone pill?
Yes, there's data in general to say that taking the hormone contraceptive pill reduces the risk of ovarian cancer, and that risk is proportional to the duration of use. And the suggestion is that the protection comes from decreased ovulation. So decreased cycling is what's considered protective. And so I'm not aware of any implications of whether it's what kind of contraceptive pill, because I think it's the mechanism is by decreased cycling. So I think that the type of pill doesn't necessarily matter. The only thing to sort of think about or bear in mind is there is a small theoretical risk of breast cancer with the oral contraceptive pill. And so, you know, what I would say to women, and, you know, what I've always said this is that, you know, a lot of that is driven by older pill formulations, to be fair. So this theoretical risk may not be true with newer formulations with different kinds of dosing at this stage. But also, again, thinking about the context. So not to use a contraceptive pill necessarily as a risk reducing tool the way we would use some other drugs. However, if it suits a woman for their lifestyle to use the oral contraceptive pill as contraception, that may be a good option for them. But just that slight question of the theoretical potential, but probably not something we need to worry hugely about, but that theoretical potential for breast cancer risk. So again, this is an individualized decision for a patient, but in general, the oral contraceptive pill does decrease the risk of ovarian cancer.
I never knew that before. So we have a query in from someone stating that her daughters are 20 and 25 and they want to get genetic testing done. The wait list is so long in the public system and they can't afford to pay for it privately. Would you recommend using Color Genomics in America? It has been advised by a consultant, and she just mentions that they are an accredited organization and used internationally.
Yeah, so it's a couple of things. So it is true, unfortunately, that the wait time for genetic testing in the public system is relatively long. We unfortunately were considered an elective service for most of last year and were shut for large portions of the year and not really functioning at all. And so the wait list that was not too bad actually at one stage, not great, but not too bad, is now terrible again. So the first thing is we are working on that and hoping to improve that situation soon. But that's obviously going to take a little bit of time to clean that up. The next thing is, at what age should you do genetic testing? So, you know, in general, testing is, we consider doing genetic testing at the age of potential for intervention. And so for BRCA, what you think about doing genetic testing in women is roughly around the age of 25. And, you know, that's partly based because in the United States, they start MRI screening at the age of 25. Now here we start at 30 for most women, depending on their family history, sometimes a little younger, depending on the context. And that'd be similar in the UK. So for women who have a BRCA mutation, this sort of going back to, of course, we want to be better resourced, we want to have a better service. But in the meantime, we work with what we've got and try and have workarounds. And so I encourage people to be referred early. So, you know, when I was working in America, if someone came to me at 20 looking for BRCA testing, I probably would have said to them to think very carefully about that. And we would have, you know, counseled them very carefully about their decision making and not turn them away, but we did not encourage genetic testing in any way at that age. And, you know, as people in their formative years, for lots of people, they have a lot of decisions to make in life, and having this additional information or this decision can be very stressful. And if it's not going to change anything that you can or would do right now, you know, that may be adding an extra load in terms of stress and anxiety. Here, because of the system, I triage the referrals that we get in the Cancer Genetic Service in St. James's. And because I know the waiting list is about 2 years, if I get a referral for a 20-year-old, you know, we would have been very careful in America about whether or not they wanted that appointment. Would have been the first question to them. Do you really want to know this now, or do you want to come here now? Because, you know, their wait list for testing would have been a few months as opposed to a couple of years. So, but as a workaround for our current system, I make a routine appointment, and I know that, you know, that 20-year-old won't get an appointment, unfortunately, for about 2 years, but maybe that's okay because they're 20. And actually for a 25-year-old, maybe that's okay too. So that's one way of looking at it. If you're not going to start doing screening till 30 for most women, you know, is that a reasonable approach? Not as a solution and not as what we want to, you know, be looking towards, but for the minute, to be proactive about referrals rather than sort of waiting till the age of testing. But there are other options. So the other options, as your asking the question points out, there are options through the private system where, yes, the waiting list will be shorter. And there are options for what's called direct-to-consumer genetic testing. So direct-to-consumer genetic testing is not without caveats, but there may be some good options there. So the first thing to be mindful of is what is it that you're doing? So ancestry-based testing is not cancer genetic testing. And sometimes when people get information from ancestry-based tests, they do get information about certain cancer gene mutations, but that information is extremely limited and you need to be very careful about it. And so if people ever get that information from an ancestry-based test, sometimes it's through uploading of their data to another server, but just to be very cautious about that information. And all of that needs to be rechecked because those data servers don't necessarily have the specificity that a clinical testing lab would have. So where people are given this information that they have a BRCA mutation, for example, and then we do clinical testing and actually they don't. And so that's a sort of emerging issue, particularly in the United States. I don't know how much of an issue it has been here yet, but something to be very mindful of. What is available also, though, is inherited genetic testing through direct-to-consumer testing like Color Genomics. And there's another company in the United States that does it, but I think Color Genomics is probably the only one that's available internationally. And they do have, I believe, availability of genetic counselors, so you could do some pre-test counseling. They are an accredited lab. As they're a commercial company, they don't release their data, but in general, they'd be considered to be a sort of robust clinical testing lab. They do have some limitations, so people need to be aware of that. They're all kind of outlined, but you know, for something like a known BRCA mutation in the family, you should give them the information of that BRCA mutation because they need to know specifically what they're looking for, just like any other genetic testing company. But for example, PMS2, which is one of the Lynch syndrome genes, is a very technically challenging gene to analyze. And Color and some other companies, but they, you know, have well-recognized limitations, which they would be very direct about. But, you know, people may not be familiar with this world necessarily, may not know about that. So doing that kind of testing may be an option that some people choose to pursue. If they do direct-to-consumer genetic testing and they want to discuss their results, we are happy to accept referrals from people, but they need to include as much for all referrals, but especially in this context, as much information as possible, including actual test results. Because I find when I get referrals from the doctors, sometimes they write something or transcribe something in the results and match you when we go and get it. It may be slightly different. So to get as much information to us as possible, but if people choose to do the testing this way and they want to discuss the results, we're happy to see people. They don't have to have the testing with us necessarily. I would much rather they had good post-test genetic counseling and appropriate follow-up than be kind of stuck trying to figure it out by themselves. Different options depending on what suits people. Early referral is an option. The private system is an option. Direct to consumer is an option, but just be careful that you're doing it with the right company. And then, of course, the biggest thing or the biggest, greatest option is shouting louds with some advocacy so we can have a better national service in time, hopefully, and not have such a long waiting list. But that, of course, will take some work.
And Karen, is the wait list as long for the people that just want to discuss their results that they've got from the external company?
No. I try and see them quicker because I feel like that's it. So we do have a triage system, mainly the urgency of triage. It's very challenging because doing triage is very challenging because everyone who's on our waiting list has a potential, you know, genetic test pending. Even if we say ultimately that they don't need genetic testing, but from their perspective, they have a potential genetic test pending and the anxiety associated with that. So the urgency in our world can't change on the basis of people being anxious about their testing, because that's everybody on our waiting list. So it's very difficult. And I feel bad for people on our waiting list. I know it's very tough. But in general, the time to an appointment is based on, will it change your cancer care right now? So for example, women who have breast cancer who might need that information for surgical decision making, if they're having chemo before their surgery, we try and get them in during the duration of their chemo. For women who have ovarian cancer who might have eligibility for a PARP inhibitor, we try and get them in before they need that information for that decision, that kind of thing. So we have very limited manpower, so that is our those kind of scenarios are a key priority. But then after that, people who have this kind of testing, who haven't had genetic counseling. So it'd be slightly different if someone moved back to Ireland, for example, and they've had genetic counseling in the United States. I'd be less worried about that person. I feel hopefully they've had good information. And, you know, as I said, we're just trying to juggle between every person and trying to be fair on our waiting list. If people say, yeah, did direct to consumer testing themselves, got a mutation identified, and, you know, this is the first they know about it, we still have to prioritize the, in particular, the women who are having breast cancer surgery who, are not having chemotherapy. We're trying to get them in really quickly if relevant or if appropriate. And then after that kind of space of it'd be a few months, but not a few years for an appointment.
And is there a trial that provides fast and effective genetic testing ongoing in Ireland? And it just says query between Beaumont and St. James's Hospital and similar to the Royal Marsden with a turnaround of 2 to 3 weeks for genetic testing. And do you know anything about this pilot project and how?
Yes. Yes. So yes, there is, but it's not available to everybody. So it is for people who have a cancer diagnosis who might be eligible for a PARP inhibitor. There's what's called direct ordering, which means that their medical oncologist can order BRCA testing to see if they're eligible for that drug. And so that's currently applicable to women who have metastatic breast cancer or advanced ovarian cancer. So any oncologist in the country can do that. The testing labs are in St. James's and Beaumont. It's not specifically being run in those places, but that is in the context of people who have a cancer diagnosis who are potentially eligible for that therapy. So that's, you know, not everyone, I'm afraid. So some people who may be listening who are waiting for genetic testing, who thankfully don't have a cancer diagnosis, they wouldn't, that's not an option available to them.
Perfect. Moving on to PARP inhibitors, we touched off them briefly. PARP inhibitors can be used in the treatment of BRCA cancers. Can you tell us when they can be used and how do they work?
Yeah, so I start by how do they work. So, we have DNA damage all the time. All of our cells have DNA damage. And, you know, your cells need to repair that damage. But when you have a cancer cell, you don't want them to repair their damage, because if they don't repair their damage successfully, then that cancer cell, the hope is, will die off. So when people have a BRCA-associated cancer, they have a vulnerability in that repair pathway. So that's one hit to the tumor. It's not so good at that repair. And then if you take a PARP inhibitor, it hits the pathway in another place. So you get two hits, and it's that what we call synthetic lethality that stops the cancer cell from repairing. And then the cancer cell should die off in theory. So for women who have an advanced ovarian cancer, so that's stage 3 or 4 at diagnosis, they can get a PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy if they have a BRCA mutation either in their genes or the tumor's genes, which is a somatic BRCA mutation. And then for women with recurrent ovarian cancer who have what's called platinum sensitive disease, they can have also PARP inhibitor maintenance. There's sort of main eligibility in Ireland. For women who have metastatic breast cancer that's HER2 negative, they can also have, they may also potentially be eligible for PARP inhibitor if they have a BRCA mutation. And there's new eligibilities coming, but not quite here yet, in prostate and pancreas cancer, potentially, again, for people who have a BRCA mutation. In ovarian cancer, PARP inhibitors have the potential for use not just in women who have a BRCA mutation in their genes or the tumor's genes. I should say, sorry, in breast cancer, it's only in their genes that we're talking about, not the tumor's genes. So in the recurrent ovarian cancer space, people can be offered a PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy, even if they don't have a BRCA mutation, because many ovarian cancers have vulnerabilities in that same pathway, even if it's not through a BRCA mutation. It's just so people are clear about that. If their doctor is giving them a PARP inhibitor and they've been told they don't have a BRCA mutation, that may well be correct. But in other cancers, in particular in breast cancer, it's in the context of a BRCA mutation.
And what causes a somatic BRCA1 gene mutation in ovarian cancer? And is there a higher risk of recurrence because of it?
Yeah, so a somatic mutation, like you just said, is a mutation in the tumor's genes. And there's lots of mutations in tumor genes. So for example, in high-grade serous ovarian cancer, almost all of them have what's called a P53 mutation. And that's a mutation within the tumor that affects the tumor's ability to regulate. And it's part of how tumors kind of go awry, if you wish, and they grow in a kind of uncontrolled manner, which is what makes them a cancer. So within cancers and within certain types of cancer in particular, you can get mutations in BRCA in the tumor's genes, and they're nothing to do with the patient's genes. So in ovarian cancer and high-grade serous ovarian cancer, about 5 to 7% of them will have a somatic or tumor BRCA mutation. And so for women who have that identified in their tumor, that is nothing to do with their genes and won't have any impact on their family. But what it does mean is that upfront PARP inhibitor approval does cover both somatic and germline BRCA mutations, because we know PARP inhibitors work about the same regardless of where the mutation is coming from. I'll just have a slight caveat to that, though, is there is depends on, a little bit on how your testing is done. If people have tumor testing done through certain commercial companies, which is usually in a self-pay setting, it doesn't always separate out whether the mutation is coming from your genes or the tumor's genes. So people need to be a little careful. When I say that a tumor mutation doesn't have impact on the other cancer risk for them or their family members, that's presuming that we know that the mutation is specifically in the tumor only and not in their genes. Some tests that test the tumor, you'll find your own BRCA mutation in that tumor, but you have to separate them out. And if the type of testing doesn't separate them out, you don't know whether it's coming from your genes or the tumor's genes. In terms of the other pieces, they're higher risk of recurrence because of it. Actually, no, the opposite would be true. So in general, for women who have a BRCA-associated ovarian cancer, whether it's either their own genes, the germline, or the tumor's genes, that's somatic, their response to platinum-based therapy is in general better. Their prognosis is in general better, and their response to PARP inhibitor is in general better. So it doesn't increase your risk of recurrence. In fact, your outcome will be likely to be better if you have a somatic or germline BRCA mutation in comparison to a wild-type tumor, although that's a huge generalization.
Brilliant, thank you. And what are some of the common side effects seen with PARP inhibitors?
So the main things people get are nausea and fatigue. You can get anemia, is pretty common as well. And then we watch out for other things like liver function, kidney function. Some women get diarrhea. They don't find that common. You can get rash or photosensitivity. And then there's a couple of, there's sort of main things. There are some rare side effects that are important. So there's about a 1% risk of having a myelodysplastic syndrome or leukemia from a PARP inhibitor. So that's something that I tell people about, even though it's very rare, it's possible. And actually in the clinical trials for women with ovarian cancer, women who got placebo also had a risk of MDS or AML, although their risk was lower. So it's something just to be aware of, although very rare. And then there's a very rare risk of pneumonitis or lung inflammation as well with PARP inhibitors. But the kind of day-to-day main side effects are fatigue and nausea, vomiting for some people, but usually it's nausea, queasiness, altered taste, decreased appetite, that kind of stuff.
Brilliant. I suppose it's a lot of side effects people with going through cancer treatment are probably very familiar with.
Yeah. It is, but, you know, and it's a tricky thing, though, because the upfront PARP inhibitors, just to sort of give you a little context for some people. So after they finish chemo, they take a PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy for 2 years. So 2 years for people who are having a lot of side effects can be tough going. But for most women, they're actually very well tolerated. In general, they have more side effects in the first month or two, and then they improve, either because of dose reductions or because they just get used to it and somehow their body kind of resets to it. But we know from the clinical trials and from using these drugs are not very long approved in Ireland in this setting, the upfront setting, but we've been using them for a long, I'm not long back from the United States, we've been using them for a long time and very familiar with their profile. And it is that in general, women do improve, their tolerance to them improves over time. For some women, unfortunately, it's not tolerable, but that's relatively uncommon.
That's something we would see as well. It's very rare that it's not tolerated. Yeah. When taking PARP inhibitors, there is a list of things that you shouldn't take, like orange juice and alcohol, just to name a few of them. Does taking these affect the effectiveness of the drugs?
Yeah, so so there's different formulations. So, for example, one of the brands is called Olaparib, and it was available in a tablet form, and now it's available in a capsule form, or both, actually. So some women might be on different versions of it at this time. And then there are other brands, for example, Niraparib is also available. Rucaparib for some women may be an option. So it depends a little bit on the drug. But in general, the thing with citrus and some drugs is they affect a pathway in the liver that these drugs are also cleared by, and that can affect there can be interactions between them. I'm not sure the interaction with dairy. I wasn't familiar with that. That might be the tablet formulation of Olaparib, I'm not sure. Alcohol in general, modest or moderation, a small amount of alcohol isn't necessarily an issue. But again, clearing through the liver is the question there.
Perfect. And so I suppose just from our point of view, would we normally see the liver function go off? Is that the kind of things that we'd be keeping an eye on as nurses?
Liver and kidneys, and then anemia is the big thing. So from the kidney point of view, though, you have to be a little bit mindful because PARP inhibitors actually affect clearance. So sometimes when creatinine is elevated, it's not a true elevation. Their actual renal function may be normal. And so if that's a question, a 24-hour urine collection can sort that out. But in women with gynecologic cancers, they can get a pressure on their kidneys. Sometimes we call that hydronephrosis. And so that's always something you have to think about too when their kidney tests are not on track.
Has research shown that immunotherapy can be an effective way to treat Lynch syndrome related cancers? And if so, can it be offered to patients instead of the standard chemo for ovarian and endometrial cancer?
So yes, is the first part. Yes, immune therapy can be a good treatment for metastatic. So that's recurrent metastatic, what we call mismatch repair deficient cancers. So mismatch repair deficiency is it's to do with how the cancer is driven or the biology of the cancer. And most Lynch syndrome associated cancers are mismatch repair deficient. Although you can have Lynch syndrome and have a mismatch repair proficient tumor, although that's relatively rare. But what's more common is you can have a mismatch repair deficient tumor and not have Lynch syndrome. So just because you might find yourself in that space doesn't mean you necessarily have Lynch syndrome. So there are a number of endometrial colon cancers, for example, that are mismatch repair deficient, but don't have Lynch syndrome. So that's the first piece. The other thing, though, is that is, so the FDA approved a drug called pembrolizumab, what we call agnostically, in about 2017. So that means they didn't approve it as the kind of more standard way. This was the first time this has really happened, where they give an approval in colon cancer or endometrial cancer or breast cancer or specific cancer based on specific data. What they did, they said, was mismatch repair deficient cancers are sensitive to this drug. You get a good response and the duration response is usually good. And so they made this agnostic approval. I'm not back in Ireland very long, but my understanding is the European agency does not have agnostic approval, and we don't have the drug here, but I don't think that it's available in that context in Europe. There is a approval coming in colon cancer soon, and hopefully a potential endometrial cancer approval coming down the line, although I'm not exactly sure what the timelines will be. These are not necessarily offered instead of chemo, though. So, for example, in endometrial cancer, if someone had metastatic disease, the first line therapy would still be chemotherapy, and then the second line therapy will be immunotherapy, although that's changing as well. There's a great immune therapy and targeted therapy combination that's now approved second line for all endometrial cancers in the United States, or mismatch repair proficient, and then they can have the pembrolizumab alone if it's deficient. But there's new data coming soon about the frontline setting, whether or not chemotherapy first is better or whether that's necessary. So all of that is coming down the tracks for people with advanced or metastatic disease, but not in the context of early stage disease yet. Whether or not that'll ever be a question, I don't know.
Brilliant. Thanks a million. It's great to see how interested people are. I think you've got the biggest amount of questions.
Yeah, really wanted to work tonight.
Plenty of questions. Well, hopefully we give some people good information. I think the key to all things is as much information as possible. And hopefully with awareness, we can, you know, really make great progress. And, you know, from my point of view, the more awareness people have of inherited risk of cancer, the more testing we do, the more people know about the risk, the more we can prevent cancers. And, you know, although we've done such great things in terms of therapies in gynae cancers, it's been amazing over the last 5 or so years, the new drugs and all the great progress. But really, wouldn't it be better if we prevented all of these cancers if we could? So to start, at least for people who we know have high-risk mutations, test all their family members, prevent cancers where we can, that's the key. So a lot of advocacy and pushing for resources, but we'll get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's great to have you back from America. Yeah.
Karen, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Answers for Cancers podcast. Please share this podcast with anybody who you think it might help. Also, if you can like and subscribe, it lets people know we're here. You can alternatively contact us on Instagram at theanswersforcancers_podcast. And if you have any questions on anything that we discussed today, please email us at theanswersforcancerspodcast@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Instagram.